take your protein pills. The Poisoned Electric Head Story.
Brain Coma. Chapter 33. Payback in the Paybar. Squat. No matter how often you say it, it still conjures up images of a scatological nature. Crude. Base. A feces release in a fetal position. The adolescent Dali's spattered trousers. A skid-marked kiss from Hieronymus Bosch. The reeking, pungent riposte to Freud's anal-retentive sphincter of sexual guilt. Am I labouring the point somewhat? Either way, it doesn't sound like a good place for a gig. So Poisoned Electric Head didn't need a second invite to Holland's premier communal toilet in the oddly contrasting picture postcard town of Leiden. A large part of the attraction was that this would be our first foray on foreign soil, something alluring and long overdue. But bearing in mind what happened on our first foray out of town in Chapter 7, we should have seen the warning signs in 7-foot-high neon letters. Or perhaps we'd learnt a valuable lesson and acquired some self-control. Things went relatively smoothly despite the loose cannon ratio being raised by the presence of knocker Neil James, whom Bill had invited along without consulting anyone first, naturally. This raised a few hackles because of limited space. But Neil was okay. He was a fellow drummer from Genghis Grimes and shared Bill's appetite for mayhem like most drummers. He got his nickname from his propensity for being, as Saucy Jack might say, a bit Andy. In short, for twatting people, thankfully in his younger days. His semi-psychotic past expedited his integration into the Poisoned Electric Head camp, and within a short time, everyone was glad he'd come along. It was nice to have some new company, and his gratitude for being invited shone through, amplifying the boozy excitement vibe. We slept at Harwich Docks, pissed and concertina-like, and boarded the ferry at around 1:30 p.m. the next day. It was a gloriously sunny afternoon as we pulled out to sea, the ship's frothy wake extending into the distance, hypnotically from our vantage point on the upper deck. But before you start humming the Oneidin line, this group appreciation of nautical splendour was merely us killing time until the duty-free shop opened. Approximately 20 minutes later, once the boat was clear of UK tax restrictions, we trooped down en masse to marvel at the goods on display. AF's cider senses were tingling instantly, and he proposed that interested parties chuck in a pound each for a litre of cheap brandy for the drinking of, on the deck, to complement the scenery. Everyone knows, of course, that duty-free purchases must not be consumed until after leaving the vessel, but fuck that right off. There was slim chance of that rule being enforced, short of throwing us overboard or the reintroduction of keel hauling. There's a scene in Gremlins when Gizmo the Nice Mogwai realises the others have been fed after midnight and groans in horror of the impending chaos. That about describes Bun's expression as he watched the rest of us get steadily lashed, an island of self-restraint in a sea of irresponsibility. Gremlins made quite an impression on us when we watched it on the cinema, as we managed to be both on the front row and on acid. During the scene where all the gremlins are watching Snow White, I glanced behind at the packed auditorium, only to see exactly what was on the screen. A cinema full of chattering goblin-faced trolls trashing the place. Fear put the wind up me, I can tell you. Frightened the wits out of me mum and dad. You can bet they soon taught me how to swim after that. Before too long, the pound coins were out again for another bottle, and that warm, euphoric sensation of well-being spread through us in thick, glutinous waves. It was time to explore and see what amusement we could find to get us through the six-hour crossing. We found a large bar area with a stage at the stem of the ship, where a cabaret band was murdering Beatles standards, and this was where Phil and me settled to watch the show. We were soon joined by Bill and Knocker, carrying a crate of Newcastle Brown, which they unceremoniously dumped onto the table to the cry of, "Dig in, lads, there's plenty more where that came from." Crew and passengers looked on nonplussed as they waded in, any discretion long since withered away with rum and replaced with willful disregard and a glassy-eyed bonhomie. Not long after, AF appeared at the top of the spiral staircase, overlooking the stage as the band finished a number. He unleashed a torrent of abuse, followed by his trademark banshee cackle, before scampering down and making a beeline for the crate, like some wax cotton gargoyle. Just like Hull, it was all spinning wildly out of control again. And at this point, from my perspective at least, the details become somewhat blurred. I do remember a kiddie swimming pool full of rubber balls that Phil rather enjoyed and was later sick in, and falling over a lot. And then suddenly we docked, and everyone was disembarking. A dim memory of Billy pointing at an enormous number painted on the vehicle deck wall swam into view, but too briefly to be of any assistance, so Phil and me set about finding the van by instinct. This proved to be more difficult than we thought, and we were soon the only passengers still on board, as each attempt led us to increasingly bizarre cul-de-sacs. At one point we thought we'd cracked it, but the lift doors opened and we were confronted by chef's hats and bemused waiters. Things had reached a by any means possible stage, a strategy that eventually led us to the top of an escalator. At the bottom, through my drunken haze, I could just make out Billy pointing upwards, surrounded by peaked cap officials. And then, like a shutter dropping in a coin-operated telescope, the picture cut out. The next thing I saw was a windmill. It was daylight and I was lying in the back of our stationary vehicle, staring through the window at it. My head felt like someone had put an axe through it. As I sat up, the pain transferred to my legs, which were a tattered mess of ripped denim and dried blood. My groans alerted the others that I had woken up, and a barrage of empty beer cans bombarded me. The noise woke Phil, who received the same treatment. He looked as bad as I did, like he'd been lowered into a pit of starving jackals raised on punk meat. We could barely walk, and no one spoke to us for 2 days. Still, I suppose that we were better off not knowing. The windmill was on a roundabout in the square, and opposite was the squat in question, a warehouse with a large yard behind two huge metal gates. Someone went to make contact, and returned saying we could drive the van inside. At this point, me and Phil were still very much the bad guys. Our stupid behaviour could have jeopardised the whole shebang. But we were drunk. Bill and Billy were models of sobriety when they pulled their stunt, and it would have repercussions that were memorable, to say the least. Within minutes of being introduced to our hosts for the week, Bill was on the roof. Billy had been informed that our appearance would be at the demolition party on Saturday. The following day, everyone would leave the squat, or what was left of it, and the evicting officers would step in on Monday. Now, scrap metal salvaging has never really appealed to me. It seems like a lot of arsing around for not much in return, other than a bad back and a court appearance. But Billy and Bill's eyes ka-chinged like cash registers at the news. They were in business together at the time as roofers, and before you could say Harry H. Corbett, they were stripping the rafters. Our hosts were oblivious to this literal interpretation of make yourself at home, but it didn't escape everyone's attention. Other people were aware of the lucrative potential in lead roofing, like the bloke who slept underneath for one. As the closest thing to a rightful owner, he'd intended to take it, and suddenly two strangers were helping themselves. And besides, there was nearly a week to go. What if it rained? He was understandably peeved and apparently said so. But what then transpired is a mystery. The whole incident filtered through to the rest of us as hearsay and half-truth. An hour later, they'd managed to discreetly disappear, find a scrap merchant and come back with the cash as if nothing had happened. Still, we were all grown men, much as we hated to be reminded of the facts. And out on the road, it was often wiser to let things drop if someone gave out a warning vibe not to push it. So we settled into the situation and took stock of our surroundings. The squat leader showed us our facilities. There was a communal lounge with an open fire where some of us could sleep, like a log, hey, and a heinous bucket set up for a toilet, which was emptied daily into a large container. What they did with that is anyone's guess, but I suppose at this stage in the game, it would remain as a gift for the bailiffs. Squat? Rather not. For the price of a beer, any number of bars in the area would offer a typhoid-free alternative. None of the dogs around the place remotely resembled an Andrex puppy, strangely enough. The week was spent mooching around the place, hanging around the van, listening to tunes and making daily morning trips to Dig Ross, the supermarket, for a crate of 24 each. This would usually last the day, and once we'd got our heads around the recycling system, any unconsumed beers would be hastily necked the next morning before returning the empties. Knocker was particularly impressed by the roasted chicken vending machines in the streets, and of course, chips and mayonnaise. We played an unremarkable concert in a club in the town with the Newcastle band The Dead Flowers sometime in the middle of the week and spent a raucous night in nearby Amsterdam. And one other evening sticks in my mind. I don't know where we'd been, but me, Bill and Knocker headed for the communal room to crash out. And before long, various characters wandered in, as was the case with this establishment. A little mouthy guy who'd been thrown into one of the canals was being mouthy about it. And some other guy, who was possibly a girl, was humouring him. Then the guy-girl asked Mouthy for a light, so he grabbed a burning log from the fire and brandished it in his face in a provocative and threatening manner. An argument ensued, featuring remarks like, "What the fuck are you anyway?" and "I'm a fucking shemale fucker, this is the fucking 90s, this is Holland," etc. And eventually Shemale and Mouthy told each other to fuck off and went looking for alternative company. We were all pretending to be asleep and secretly enjoying the show when Shemale went over to Knocker of all people and shook him, asking for a light. He was the perfect gentleman, possibly had been asleep and thought he'd copped in the flickering half-light from the fire. Thankfully, this scenario never developed further in terms of sex or violence or both. Just polite conversation. But I'd like to think that Knocker also thought that this was the fucking 90s in Holland. And what the fuck, isn't that chicken in a machine top, mate? On the day of the gig, we were shown the area where the performance would take place. It was a bare concrete room, no furniture, no lights, a few windows and a bit of a balcony from the upper floor. "When are the PA and lights coming?" somebody asked optimistically, and the guy's face registered an expression as if we'd asked if his brother-in-law's diving helmet was made of cheese. "Oh well, it looked like a backline job then, in pitch black. But not to worry, we'd been in worse situations, or so we thought." We arranged a suitable time to set up the gear, and then faced the void of nothingness that exists before a gig, that screams to be filled with alcohol. Our professional self-discipline was probably a little more lax than usual, but nothing too reckless was indulged in. And then as the hour approached, it became apparent that Bill and AF hadn't been seen in a while, and the jungle drums revealed that they had opted for a full refusal, a no-show, a non-appearance of the two Davids. Do you remember the spitting image puppets of David Steele and David Owen? One was significantly bigger than the other, and the smaller one was always creeping around him sycophantically. You get the picture. And what's more, they had secreted themselves in one of Leiden's many watering holes, where they intended to stay until it was all over. This was bad news, as Bill particularly could be stubborn and non-yielding when he wanted to be. But we didn't come all this way to be shat on, so a search party was hastily assembled. We pooled our information. Where had they been a lot this week? Were there any bars that captured their imagination? Which bars provided beer and pot? Al remembered a place that Bill had taken a shine to, so the two of us visited it, and sure enough, there they were. Bill threw Al a betrayed glance as we entered, then dug his heels in firmly and refused to leave despite all reasonable pleas and arguments. He met every overture with steadfast rejection. His tone, that of Ripley in Aliens, being asked to return to the mining planet. His eyes saying, "Forget it. No horses exist that could possibly be wild enough." When we pushed him further on the matter, he turned old soothsayer, pointing theatrically, and prophesying doom if we continued on this reckless path. I couldn't understand it. Okay, so it wasn't Brixton Academy, but what the fuck? It was our whole reason for being in Holland. Shit gig or no shit gig, let's just finish the job. So kicking and screaming all the way, He reluctantly returned, full of on-your-head-be-it style disclaimers. Bill had never struck me as the superstitious type, but this particular scenario had him well spooked. A relieved welcoming committee awaited us on returning, and we hastily set about carting the gear inside the now dimly lit cellar. Luckily, I had a small spotlight, which I used for on-stage visibility. This was attached to the wall and provided the only source of light as we plugged in and attempted a primeval sound check. Some DJ decks arrived, and with them a strobe, which once plugged in remained on for the rest of the night. It was set to a really slow frequency to create a disconcerting, disjointed effect to every movement. It was only possible to see anything every other second. The sound we achieved was as rough and nasty as you can expect, but it was all we had. It was all anyone had. This, the burrest of burr-ass gigs, with its staggered Victorian magic lantern lighting and slaughterhouse chic decor. People began to filter in, and we quickly retired to the van to don the outfits before returning to do what we came to do. It was a distorted, cacophonous and disorientating sound that emerged as the first number. Al was doing his best to tidy it up, but in the end, all that we could do was let it fly. It spluttered and roared, and in such surroundings was poetically appropriate, and at the end of the song, the ramshackle ragbag around roared back in appreciation. Result, against all odds, we steamed valiantly into the next tune, picking up momentum as we adapted to the conditions. This was showing all the signs of being one to remember. And then, in the middle of the third number, the world ended. The song fell into the abyss and was replaced by screams, shouts and flailing chaos. I stopped playing and turned to look at Phil, who was trying to make sense of the madness. He appeared to be covered in nuclear waste or napalm or something, his face a twisted mask of rage. A frozen tableau in the midst of an earthquake. Jesus, it was all over me. What the fuck was it? Had the roof fell in? The sky is falling and I want my mummy. Move the gear, was the urgent cry. Amps and keyboards were being dragged frantically, the leads twanging free in a whiplash frenzy like a sinking ship's rigging in a storm, as each chaotic scene was momentarily preserved for a second by the relentlessly flashing strobe. What the fuck was happening? Some sort of natural disaster? No, it was something worse. It was the rancid stench of revenge, in all its lurid glory, as the grim concrete carcass emptied its bowels onto us. Two of its inhabitants had spoken for the majority. Shit on us, and we will shit on you, they silently pronounced in this most literal expression of retribution. And the entire fecal waste of a slighted community rained down upon us. A gesture of biblical proportions, as cruel as Lot's wife or a plague of boils. The ultimate heckle. Somehow we managed to get all the equipment out to the van in one piece, where we packed it away in its stinking condition. Then we sat, shell-shocked, shitty and silent, with no idea what to do next. The big gates were locked. We couldn't leave. There were no washing facilities to clean up. We would have to brazen it out till daylight, marked men surrounded by an unknown enemy. Was this just the first taste of Dutch justice, or was there a knife or two waiting amongst the revellers? Well, fuck them. I wandered back into the fray, wide-eyed and paranoid. Some people asked me why we'd stopped playing, obviously oblivious to what had occurred. Well, pardon me for being so touchy, but I think I can tell the difference between a vat of shit and a standing ovation. Everyone I looked at was a potential assailant. I felt like Edward Woodward in The Wicker Man. There are 100 scenarios in films that echo this situation. You don't need me to name them. But you must have noticed by now that I want to. What can I say? Life imitates art, and as Gibby Haynes of Butthole Surfers once said, art is just the last three letters of fart, which is exactly what we smell like. Somehow we made it through the night, and in between the endless post-mortems of the evening's events, we maybe even got some sleep. In the morning, I went with Bill and Al to the nearby cafe for a brew. No one in the place would make eye contact with us, but intermittently someone, or possibly everyone, was throwing beer mats at our table. It was time to go. When we returned, the van was outside the gates. We climbed aboard and drove away without a word. There was nothing to say. A little further out from the centre, we parked by a canal near a row of bars. There was some vague talk of going to Rotterdam for the day. But in the meantime, people wandered off in dribs and drabs, looking for nothing in particular. A breakaway group had settled in one of the bars, while the pothead crew sat in the front seats of the van smoking and bullshitting. AF was mad keen to get moving, and had clicked into his surrealist salesman mode. If he wanted his own way, he would rant endlessly about the positive attributes of his proposal, becoming increasingly absurd as he randomly embellished the truth with fictional statistics. Oh yeah, it's great. Loads better than Amsterdam. Nobody ever goes to Amsterdam. They all love Rotterdam. The drugs are free, etc., etc. So in the end, we decided to make a move, probably just to shut him up. Except the guys in the bar had announced they were staying right where they were. Christ, here we go again. By now, I was about ready to blow a gasket. It had been a running joke that someone would crack under the pressure of this gonzo lifestyle at some point during the trip, and I was more than happy to volunteer. The guys in the van roared with approval at this display of insanity as I bounded into the bar and told them all that they were a bunch of cunts. They pissed themselves laughing and bought me a drink. I went one better and shat myself in a semi-laughing, ranting, farting outburst. I dashed to the loos, removed the offending undergarments, and spotting the empty beer garden, legged outside and threw them over the wall. Into next door's beer garden, which wasn't empty. The screams haunt me to this day. Unexpected shit from above was becoming a recurring theme this week. The appeal of sitting in a bar and drinking until reality melted suddenly seemed like a good idea. But AF got his way, and we went to Rotterdam. It was everything he said it wouldn't be. Dull, cold, wet and miserable. Still, it had one thing going for it. It wasn't Leiden. Chapter 34. Men in Suits.
Yeah, so is there, does somebody actually come up with the basic structure of a song, and then you take it, you break it down, and all throw your own part in, or is it just?
Yeah, somebody comes up with it. Somebody comes.
Somebody comes up with an initial idea, but it doesn't matter who that person is. Like, if everybody's into the idea that arises, you go with it. It's just whatever idea arises that everybody is into, you go with that one. And that's all. That's how the songs come about.
So they're almost like starting from a jamming session.
Yeah. You could. A lot of them have started that way. Or by
some of them just come from noises. Yeah. Just there's no formula for it. I think it just happens a variation in different ways.
Inspiration can come from anywhere, can't it?
Everybody's a businessman these days. The charts are awash with shrewd, hard-nosed, tough cookies, more concerned with flaunting their Harvard business diplomas than their washboard stomachs and navel rings. Somewhere along the line, brand has replaced band and spawned a generation of index-linked prima donnas, all trying to make the Fortune 500. And it's all wrong. I hanker for a more innocent age when musicians had zero desire to get involved in the finances of it all and left it to a frustrated musician masquerading as a friend who systematically bled them dry. At least in those days, they could concentrate on doing what they did best, namely making music and behaving like overgrown children, even if it did leave them with a huge debt and a coke habit. Instead, we have rap artists keeping it real by launching their own line of casual streetwear. All the reward we got out of it took place on stage and in the practice room. That's where we were happiest. None of us really wanted to play hardball with the pinstriped and senile, though Billy and AF talked a good fight. The business side of things mostly fell to Bun and occasionally myself. Yet, whenever the subject of acquiring more professional representation was broached, everyone recoiled in horror. Our greatest collective fear was that of being ripped off. And why? Not because we might never recover from it, but because it was unmanly. How would we be able to hold our heads up in public if some smooth-talking southerner did us up like a kipper and took us for every penny? So consequently, every overture of help we eyed with suspicion, and in doing so, never got any further than a small town band with no major clout can expect to. In the end, though, something had to give, and when O'Brien Helene came to see us perform in London and expressed a desire to manage us, it was the least we could do to agree to meet with him. He came up to St. Helens to discuss the proposal, so we took him to the Hellenic, the greasiest greasy spoon cafe in town. We had absolutely no fucking class. But he was undeterred and eager to sign a management deal, an offer that seemingly no one had a problem with. It was the mention of the words publishing deal that set the fat flying. Not that that was an anomaly in the Hellenic. It was as if he'd suggested a sexual favours clause. Despite knowing next to nothing about the music business, we all knew that publishing meant the rights to songs, and it fitted with our world plan that we wouldn't relinquish a single bar under pain of death. After all, Frank Zappa had gone to great effort and expense to reacquire the rights to his old songs from Warner, and Paul McCartney was in the news, having been outbid by Michael Jackson for the rights to his own back catalogue, so we weren't about to get burned in a similar fashion. Even the generous figure of £20,000 could only elicit a, "Well, we'll think about it, Brian, but in all likelihood the answer's no." And he was only talking about one album's worth, not the whole output. Picture the scene, surrounded by congealed ketchup dispensers and faded 50s decor. A piss-stained Salvation Army resident on the next table, making a cuppa last all day. And us, magnanimously knocking back a five-figure sum. Brian Helene must have thought we were nuts. For much as it's hard to criticise our ideals, certain facts need to be highlighted. We weren't Frank Zappa. We certainly weren't McCartney. And the songs in question you've very likely never heard and never will. So even if they give the aforementioned artists a run for their money, it's something of a moot point. Still, despite being totally baffled, Brian Helene went off to draw up a management contract, as well as lining up an agent and a label to release the second album. Chapter 35, The Infinity Fridge of Uden. We never really endured for long the grinding schedule of tour engagements and far-flung appearances, which must be the equal parts bane and salvation of middle-range artists. For us, it was always the tingling frisson of something slowly happening and the building momentum that buoyed us along. And with Brian Helene on board, this feeling tangibly increased, even if the results didn't always measure up. One of the first manifestations of his influence was a spot at a prog rock festival in Uden, on the eastern border of Holland, which maybe qualifies as far-flung if you throw like a girl. It was the kind of booking that made our girlfriends sit up and take notice, and promptly come with us. But with Steve Hackett and IQ as headliners, it was nothing to trouble the English mainstream music press. Still, we were glad of it, and the lure of foreign climes and mainland European hospitality added greatly to its appeal. In the main, UK promoters treat you like the new lover of their estranged wife, who they have to be nice to for the sake of the kids, and the minimum of niceties they throw your way barely conceals their distaste of the situation. They begrudge paying you, feeding you, they give you the cheapest pissweak lager they can find, and then stick you in damp subterranean graffiti-ridden holding cells. Bastards. Of course, there are exceptions, and some have blown us away with their hospitality. Greg at Bolton Crown and Cushion, stand up and take a bow. But usually, your arrival is greeted with indifference and contempt. Which brings me to the rider, a concept which surely originated in the UK, and is basically a list of ransom demands that will result in a no-show if not agreed to. I'm sure abroad it's a technicality, but in the UK it's fought over tooth and claw. Artists are accused of being overly pedantic with their demands for smarties with the orange ones removed and other such prima donna whims. But tight-fisted promoters drove them to it, forcing them to draw up watertight documents that make most legal contracts look like something scrawled on the back of a beer mat. Any band used to such draconian treatment could easily lose their heads, then fill their boots when subjected to continental hospitality, which seems to be as lavish for headliners as the lowliest of support acts. Can you see where I'm going with this? The ferry crossing was slightly better behaved than in the past, probably due to the sobering presence of the girls. but it still had its moments. Bill was shamelessly paralytic on arrival, and stern warnings to not draw attention to himself still resulted in him staggering into a pyramid of oil cans, sending them cascading in all directions. He followed this with another textbook example of keeping a low profile, handing his passport in for inspection whilst on all fours. Against all odds, we were allowed entry, and we drove sedately away in our monstrously large tour bus. We'd acquired it some months earlier from another band, a 52-seater, 38-feet-long coach, which by virtue of the sink it contained was classed as a mobile home and could therefore be driven on a standard licence. This loophole in the law was of little comfort to Al, who at the time of purchase had to accustom himself to its enormous bulk on a car park for an hour before risking the roads home. The home comforts its previous owner had installed were quickly deemed surplus to our needs and unceremoniously ripped out. So it was goodbye toilet, double bed and comfy couch, and hello, military-style bunks and pissing through a hole in the floor. And though the sink survived thanks to its law-defining status, it no longer actually worked. The wisdom in ripping out the toilet still evades me to this day, but its absence produced some startling and frankly gross alternatives. No one was totally at ease with lying on the floor and sticking their manhood through a hole in the chassis. The proximity to the rotating drive shaft was reason enough, loss of dignity aside. So someone invented the bottle technique. A plastic 3-litre bottle with its base removed provided a handy receptacle when inserted neck first into the hole. But we soon graduated to a demijohn placed in the well of the door next to the driver. It even became a challenge to see how quickly we could fill it, with points awarded for contributions of volume. From there, it's only a short step to shagging mud sharks in hotel bathrooms. We were tempted to give the bus a groovy paint job befitting our status, but that was just asking to be stopped and harassed every half an hour, for sadly, in a little over 20 years, the British had gone from being the coolest race on the planet to becoming a grim, uptight nation of Jobsworths and Killjoys. How did we evolve in the space of a generation from Connery and Kane into Winton and Titchmarsh? It's a valid question. Anyway, one luxury the bus did have was an ear-splittingly loud sound system, which, though hardly state-of-the-art, with its mishmash of old hi-fi speakers, was sufficiently powerful to provide a constant raucous soundtrack. It also provided an endless source of arguments and was eternally fought over. Tastes had matured and diversified since our earliest times together, when we all seemed to have practically the same record collection, and there were now two or three musical factions all vying for airtime. Despite the long hours we had to fill, pot smoker classics competed against thrash metal, road music and left-field oddities. It was a subjective dilemma, to be sure. I, for one, could never quite equate the bleak, morbid outpourings of Roger Waters' later works with the ramshackle outlaw existence our lifestyle purported to emulate. Equally, I found the dumbass metal of Pantera and their ilk to be tiresome, impotent aggression, with less balls than an agoraphobic eunuch's convention. So this just left stupid songs to fill the gap, and there was no shortage of these. AF was once nearly battered for playing Up With The Cock by Judge Dredd 10 times in a row, positively pissing himself at its ribald 70s innuendo, and the Mac lads equally set the fur flying. Half the band loved them for their painfully accurate parodies of pisshead pillock culture, whilst the other half actually bought it at face value and saw them as spokesmen for a generation. A typical Journeys playlist would go something like this. Amused to Death, Roger Waters. We're bored to death here in the back, Billy. Put something else on. I'm Going Slightly Mad, Queen. Guaranteed to reduce AF to tears of laughter, not sadness, I hasten to add. Walk, Pantera. Bill, stop pushing your fist in my face and put your shirt back on. Various Gong, Zappa, Devo, Tangerine Dream, Hawkwind, Kraftwerk, Jean-Michel Jarre. An uneasy truce in a card game. Blur, Pulp, etc. Bloody hell, Bri, are you gay or what? That day, as we cruised into Holland, the track that encapsulated the good vibe was Devo's live acoustic version of Choco Homo. It was tailor-made for the moment.
They tell us that we lost our tail, evolving up from little snail. I say it's all just wind and sail. Are we not men? We are Devo. Whoa.
I bet you didn't know that was such a sad song.
Take your protein pills. To be continued.
Poisoned electric head, poisoned electric head, poisoned electric head, poisoned electric head.